We know great herds of bison once roamed Iowa, but did you know, much farther back in time, there were woolly mammoths, mastodons, and even giant sloths? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, Bill Clark of Iowa State University will tell us about animals that disappeared from our state with the arrival of European settlers, and how some species, like black bears, bobcats, and even cougars, are coming back. Then, Holmes Semkin of the University of Iowa will tell us about creatures that inhabited Iowa much farther back during the last ice age. First, a look at this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know great herds of bison once roamed Iowa. But did you know much farther back in time there were also woolly mammoths, mastodons, and even giant sloths? Well, later in the hour, Holmes Semkin of the University of Iowa will tell us about these creatures that inhabited Iowa during the last ice age thousands of years ago. First, though, it's kind of like a time machine. We're not going to go back quite that far. We want to go back a few hundred years. We want to find out more about the animals that disappeared from our landscape much more recently with the arrival of European settlers, and how, with changes to the law and environment, some species like black bears, bobcats, and even cougars are coming back. Perhaps you've heard about them in the news. Joining me to talk about that, Bill Clark is with us in our Ames studio, professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology at Iowa State University. Bill Clark, great to have you with us on the program today.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
So let's go back to Iowa, our landscape, before it was known as Iowa, before Europeans were here. What sorts of animals were around that aren't around today?
Well, as you've already said, before Europeans settled the state of Iowa and the whole North American continent, of course, bison and elk were distributed widely across the continent. In fact, their big predators like wolves and cougars followed them around. As cougars, we often refer to as mountain lions, were also present in Iowa before what we might say prehistory. When you think about the incredible abundance of these large mammals, for example, we don't really know how many bison there were across the continent, but numbers like 500 million bison across the entire continent, ranging all the way to the Appalachians, elk as numerous. And of course, then as Europeans settled the landscape and changed things, these species disappeared for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
For example, when Lewis and Clark first went up our western border in 1804, most of these large species were already sparse in Iowa, pushed to the west of at least the Mississippi River, although they were still present in Iowa. Lewis and Clark first encountered bison just northwest of Iowa. In fact, that's where they killed their first bison. They saw their first wolf just below Council Bluffs.
Mm-hmm. So Lewis and Clark wouldn't have seen these famed seas of bison blackening the landscape?
They certainly did when they moved a little further west. And in the Dakotas is when bison are really better adapted to sort of the shorter grass prairies in the central part of our plains. But they were common in Iowa. We still get reports. Occasionally people will bring in a piece of an elk antler or a piece of a petrified bison skull to my office asking what it is that they've picked up along some Iowa stream that's been eroded. So these species were once common in Iowa.
Okay. If you River to River listeners have a question about any of the creatures that used to roam our Midwest landscape hundreds of years ago, Bill Clark is with us. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or email, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You mentioned elk. Is it true that at one time elk and bison were more abundant than deer in Iowa?
Very much so. Deer are a species of kind of edges and so on. White-tailed deer were certainly here historically, but by far the largest abundance was bison, elk, and many more than white-tailed deer. In fact, white-tailed deer almost disappeared from the state, essentially did disappear from the state except in a few places by the time the late 1800s, early 1900s. In fact, one of the things that's important for people to realize is that the biggest changes in Iowa's landscape and these really large mammals that used to occur here occurred after the Civil War and on into through the Industrial Revolution and into the early 1900s, 1920s and 1930s. The biggest changes in Iowa's landscape in terms of agriculture were in that period between 1900, 1920, 1930, when agriculture became much more intensive.
So a lot of land plowed up for the very first time as recently as 100 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, if you go back in history, the first reports of soybeans being planted in the state were in the 1920s. Now we think of it as, you know, a corn and soybean, you know, landscape. But before that, of course, it was prairies and wetlands and patches of forest along the, especially the eastern part of the state and along the rivers.
Okay, so I'm imagining, you know, many of our listeners are driving right now, driving through this very landscape that we're talking about, or perhaps looking out a kitchen window or something as we talk today, Bill. Take us back to before this all happened and how Iowa, describe it, how Iowa looked physically, the landscape before this European settlement and great change.
So if you were to somehow take a wagon from southeastern Iowa along the river corridor, say follow the Des Moines River corridor and so on, as you crossed Iowa to the northwest, you would have gone from a landscape that had less and less trees to mostly, in fact, two-thirds of the state really was vast prairie and wetland complexes. You would have seen prairie and tall grasses and wetlands. And, of course, that's the landscape that these large animals inhabited.
Mm-hmm. And so as we changed these habitats, that's when they started to disappear.
Sure. And, of course, we shot a lot of them for food. We killed the predators that were competitors, literally, with us for the bison and elk that we wanted for food. And they were, you know, considered vermin. So they were, you know, removed. So it was this combination of settlement of the landscape, changing in the landscape, and, of course, removal of the large animals by actually direct trapping and hunting that caused them to essentially disappear from the state.
And I understand there was a different type of grass introduced into Iowa by the settlers, right?
Yes, they were European settlers. The native grasses were not familiar to them. Most of the native grasses were what we call warm season grasses. They grow to their peak production in late summer. But, of course, these people wanted to grow cattle and raise livestock, and they were familiar with cool season grasses that they brought with them, smooth brome. So they literally plowed this prairie, you might say inch by inch or homestead by homestead, until they had converted what was once this, you know, enormous prairie wetland complex to a more familiar kind of pasture land that they grazed their livestock and eventually, of course, plowed and planted row crops of all sorts.
So when we see grass, I don't know, grass in our yard or somewhere else, how do we know whether it's the European variety or the variety native to Iowa?
Almost all of the grasses that you see in the lawns and pastures and so on are the non-native ones. The prairie restorations that we have are the remnant prairies on state preserves and state parks and those kinds of places. Those tall grasses are the remnants, only a very, very small fraction. Mm-hmm. Less than 1% of the landscape in Iowa still has the native undisturbed prairie.
Let's go back to the elk. I love that animal. So magnificent. I've seen some out west, but we heard about a resurgence of elk in northern Iowa. The DNR didn't allow this to continue for too long. Why?
Most of the species that we're talking about were extirpated from the state so long ago that they're really no longer part of our native landscape. And in fact, in the case of the elk, they were concerned about the potential for carrying disease diseases like chronic wasting disease that might then infect our white-tailed deer herd, which is, of course, quite abundant and an important part of our landscape and also an important part of our hunting heritage. So there was concerns about that, and they didn't want the elk population to try to grow. Mm-hmm. We really don't have the landscape for them. They have much.
Yeah, the habitat could not support
that's
an
right,
elk
population. That's right, the habitat could not support.
Okay, no longer support that. Okay. There have been also sightings in Iowa of the felines, bobcats, cougars. Talk about them. They are making a comeback.
They are. In fact, actually, it's kind of interesting. Not so much the cougars, but it's interesting that when you think about all these large predators like wolves and cougars, we remove them. But many of our smaller predators actually have expanded. Coyotes, for example, certainly were removed by the early settlers, but now coyotes are actually probably more abundant across Iowa than they were at the early time of settlement. Bobcats have naturally made a comeback in the state. In fact, they're quite an adaptable species. They do very well in the brushy habitats. They're especially abundant in southern Iowa. We now have a legal harvest season on this species, but 25 years ago, they were almost non-existent in the state. This is a natural reoccurrence. Now, we have some other smaller predators like gray fox, for example, which are on the decline because of changes in our forests and that sort of thing. So we have some species that are doing quite well and sort of repopulating the landscape. We occasionally have forays by cougars. You hear a lot about them on the news. They show up in the state and people say, oh, they're going to re-inhabit the state and so on. That's very unlikely. I don't think we'll ever have a resident population of cougars. They have huge home ranges. Just for a scale, the home range of one male mountain lion might be something in the neighborhood of 250 to 300 square miles. And if you take the average size of a southern Iowa county at about 450 square miles, that's about half to two-thirds the size of one southern Iowa county for one male mountain lion.
Mm-hmm. A bobcat, on the other hand, somewhat larger than a house cat.
You know, 20 pounds. They right. They have a home range that's for the females about, you know, 8 square miles. They love brushy habitat where there's lots of rabbit prey and stuff like that. And they're quite common now in southern Iowa.
Okay. Any reason to be afraid of any of these? I was out walking a few months ago and with my dog, and all of a sudden her ears stood up. She knew something was in the brush. And sure enough, a coyote came out of there. Now, we together, not thinking, just chased it. We didn't find it. It got away, of course. But if we come across a bobcat, a coyote, a cougar, mountain lion, what should we do? Any danger there?
Well, certainly for bobcats and coyotes, you should feel privileged. In fact, you should be fascinated by the fact that we have these medium-sized predators in our landscape, and you're lucky to see one and enjoy the moment. You're definitely not. They are of no threat to you or your dog out on a walk and so on. On the other hand, people worry about the presence of cougars. It's not something that I ever would be concerned about. They're more afraid of you, even if there was one. And I emphasize, boy, these are very occasional sightings that are literally years between legitimate sightings, although we get reports all the time. Mm-hmm. Nothing to worry about. You know, they're going to take off and stay away from you more. Right. You really don't have to be concerned about
it. And as you say, if you're very lucky, you'll catch a fleeting glimpse at most.
You might be a fleeting glimpse would be the best that you could hope for.
Mm-hmm. If you should face a mountain lion, stand your ground. Do not run. Make yourself big.
Just stand there and look like a big human being, and that mountain lion's going to go the other way.
Okay. We haven't talked about black bears. Another animal, predator, higher up on the food chain, making a comeback. Where have we seen these in Iowa?
Black bears are one of the species that would have been here, especially in the eastern half of the state. They're actually becoming quite abundant in even southeastern Minnesota, southwestern Wisconsin. I think they are probably the next large predator that we will have resident in, say, northeastern Iowa. They occasionally get seen up there. I know that across the river in Wisconsin, there are populations that are sort of moving south, and I think that that's very likely at some point within the I'll stick my neck out and say the next certainly 5 to 10 years, we'll have a breeding, mom and cubs in northeastern Iowa and some of the Rocky Bluffs. Mm-hmm. In states like, for example, even heavily populated states back east, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, there are resident populations of black bears.
Now we said predator. In one of my favorite books as a kid, Blueberries for Sal, I think it was called. The black bear there, I think, only ate blueberries.
Yes. And so, in fact, actually, one of the things that's characteristic about these successful we'll call them predators, is that they tend to be generalists. They eat lots of, in the case of black bears, they eat lots of fruit and small things, small mammals and that sort of thing. They dig up ants and grubs, and so they have a very generalist diet. They are not dependent like, for example, a mountain lion would be on, large deer prey.
Okay. Now, I see that a black bear can get as large as, what, 800 pounds?
Yeah, that would be a big male. More typically, they're, females would be a couple hundred pounds, maybe 300 pounds.
If I encounter such a creature, I would be worried. Should we?
Well, if you surprised one or something like that, especially a mom with cubs, this happens all the time. People have them around their cabin in northern Minnesota, for example. And, it's not a good idea to go up and swat them on the nose and tell them shoo, although people do it all the time.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, people try to do that sort of thing. Yeah, that's okay. Asking for trouble. I think what you do is you just kind of back off and they're going to leave.
So what I hear coming through between the lines from you, Bill Clark, is that as some of these species, even some of these larger predators, come back into our landscapes, there is room, if we change our behavior, if we act accordingly, for us to coexist.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most exciting things about this story, Ben, is that it's an indication of the health of Iowa's landscape, of the natural communities, and of our changing attitudes about these species. Many of these species are fascinating just to know that we have them. Again, the really large predators, we're not going to have back in abundance by any means, and we're certainly not going to have millions of bison roaming across our landscape. But we certainly can envision an Iowa history past that with some of these species present around us.
Mm-hmm. Of the creatures we've talked about, bobcats, cougars, black bear, are they protected?
Yes, virtually all these species are protected by the Iowa DNR laws. They enjoy different status. I mean, in technical terms, cougars are no longer protected. Many of the species, like cougars, for example, that were extirpated from the state were never even included in the original wildlife code when it was written because they were long gone.
But why aren't they protected
the other species
now, though?
Are.
Why aren't they protected now?
That's a great controversy, actually, and I think we may see eventually these species being added back to the list as they sort of show up in Iowa on occasion. Mm-hmm. But there is some controversy because there's a debate as to whether they should be protected or whether they should be of concern to, for example, livestock producers who would say, no, there's no way. If we see a cougar, I want to be able to just shoot it and make sure that it doesn't establish a population in our state.
We've talked about some large animals that have disappeared from Iowa and are to some extent returning. Let's talk about some other species. I see passenger pigeons on the list. They're gone, 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 though.
They are literally extinct. The word extinct means the species no longer exists on the planet. And they once were abundant. Iowa was kind of on the western edge of where they were most abundant, but there were huge, huge flocks. Passenger pigeons are sometimes described as having migratory flocks that would darken the sky literally for days as they migrated north and set up their breeding colonies. They mm-hmm. They were once considered the most numerous bird in North America. They're completely gone now. That is the last one who died in a Cincinnati zoo, literally.
Mm-hmm. And we humans are to blame. What did we do that this
they were
hunted?
They were literally, well, we of course, once again, it's a landscape change kind of question. That's the root of it. We cut down forests, we'd so on, but passenger pigeons were particularly vulnerable because they nested in large colonies and they were commercially hunted. So you could go in and harvest huge numbers of them. They were shipped to restaurants and so on. And eventually they were not able to keep up. They have a slow breeding rate. And so the populations basically disappeared because of this enormous and unregulated removal, changes in the landscape, the forest and so on. And eventually they were wiped out.
Now, I think I've seen a stuffed passenger pigeon in a museum, and those would exist. How would they look in size and appearance different than a common pigeon we find today.
So you see little mourning doves. They look very similar to mourning doves, the small doves that we have around our bird feeders and so on. And they are just a little larger than those. They'd be a little less chunky, but a little more slender looking than the average pigeon that you would see around town.
Okay. Here's an email. I wanted to get to some feedback we've had from listeners. An email actually arrived before the show from Mike. He'd like to draw our attention to a book, actually one that I have on my bookshelf at home. It is a great book. Glad you could mention this, Mike. A Country So Full of Game by James Dinsmore, Professor Emeritus of ISU Animal Ecology, also together with you, Bill Clark, wasn't that?
Jim and I were good buddies. We worked together for 25 years. And it is a great book. I recommend it to all Iowans. It's a really nice summary of a lot of things we've been talking about.
Okay. An email from Minday. Please discuss the recent attack in Chicago. Four coyotes came after three dogs being let out. They chased the dogs up a flight of stairs. The owner got the dogs in. The coyotes didn't relent. They continued pursuit, breaking several panes of a louvered windows on a door and the glass of a second door. I just saw this on WGN. I lived in the desert, and I'm familiar with occasional pet being grabbed, but nothing like this. Thanks, Mindy.
Yeah. So one of the most interesting things is that some of these species are quite adaptable to suburbia. Red foxes now are quite common right around the studio here in Ames where I'm speaking, and they actually kind of move into suburbia sometimes. And coyotes have done that, and it's particularly true in some of the cities like Chicago. I cannot explain to Mindy why they get these really aggressive streaks like that occasionally. It's not something to be concerned about, but it often is the kind of thing that's associated with, for example, the breeding season and that sort of thing. This is about the time of the year that coyotes and foxes are and bobcats, for that matter, are beginning breeding. So it could very well be that they saw this dog as a threat. Although it's unusual for coyotes to be found in packs, typically when that happens, you can kind of guess it's a bunch of, I mean, literally, it's like teenage coyotes getting into trouble. You know, they're together, they're not breeding individuals that is dominant males and so on. They tend to be sort of, teenage coyotes getting in trouble, and I wouldn't be surprised if that had something to do with this particular circumstance.
Bill Clark, we have just about a minute left. Can you tell us what we as individuals who care about the diversity of our state, the biodiversity here, what we can do to invigorate it, what we can do to help it along, if anything?
Well, the first thing I would say, as I've said before, just enjoy the fact that, and if you do see these wildlife species, enjoy the fact that you have had the opportunity. And then the second thing I would always say is whatever your interests are, join a conservation organization, especially those that are trying to support the maintenance of our landscape and so on. And supporting conservation organizations across the board is one of the most important things, including the Iowa DNR, not just the public ones, but also the private organizations that draw attention to the value of our wildlife.
Okay. Bill Clark, thank you very much for joining us this half hour, professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology at Iowa State University, joining us from our Ames studio. We do appreciate it, Bill. Fascinating work here.
Thanks.
And when we come back, we'll give you a little hint. Who knows what movie this music is from? Well, when we come back, we'll get back in our time machine and travel back with Holmes Semkin. And he'll tell us about the creatures that inhabited Iowa thousands of years ago during the last ice age. Mammoths, mastodons, giant sloths. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Well, pick me up with golden hand. Oh, Messiah.
So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, if you guessed correctly, that music right before the break was from the movie, yes, Ice Age, which for many of us is the extent of our knowledge about this period of time. Well, perhaps you're somewhere you can gaze out at the landscape this afternoon. Perhaps you're driving while listening to us this hour, or in your kitchen. You can take a moment to look out your window. Now, imagine seeing great herds of bison that we had in that first half hour. A magnificent elk goes by, those that used to inhabit our landscape before European settlers arrived. Well, let's now travel back even farther in time to the last ice age. And then imagine what sort of creatures, what sort of beasts were roaming our landscape here in the Midwest at that time. And we have someone very good indeed to help us imagine those times. Holm Semkin is with me in the studio in Iowa City, professor emeritus of geoscience at the University of Iowa. Welcome back to our program, Holm.
Well, it's nice to be here.
So before we get to this picturescape that you're going to paint for us, tell us about the time that you're going to be concentrating on, the Ice Age period that you want us to focus on.
Okay. Basically, it's going to be the last 30,000 years, but we can turn the microscope down just a little bit more, and most of my conversation will be based on the period of time between 15,000 years and 9,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll lap over to in obviously, but
we commonly hear that the last ice age ended around 10,000 years ago.
That's correct.
So we're focusing in on the very end of a very long ice age.
That's correct.
Okay. So describe how the climate and landscape were different during this period than what we have now.
Okay. Well, the landscape in terms of the landforms was very much the same. The big difference would be that in the area of Des Moines and North Charles City, Mason City, there would be a glacial ice. That was a glacier that pulsated in and out of Iowa.
And by pulsating, you mean it took a while.
They come in jerks, so to speak. If you get a lot of snowfall in the catchment area, they advance. If they have a drought or something like that in the catchment area, they retreat. Retreat in summer. Advance in winter, retreat in summer kind of thing. And so that glacier would be there. It wouldn't be immense in the sense of the glaciers you see in Greenland today.
So it's not like we walk up to them and there's suddenly this mountain of ice rising.
No. Because where the Des Moines lobe, we call this glacier, it's a lobe of another ice sheet, there would be a lot of melting. And ice carries a lot of dirt, rocks, stones, things like that. And so when they melt, these accumulate on the surface. And so when you walk on the Ice Age glacier that was present in Iowa at that time, you'd be walking on soil.
You might not even know it.
You probably wouldn't know it. You might hear some cracking and popping from the ice moving below.
Mm. Okay.
Any trees that were growing on it might be leaning in funny directions because of this. But you wouldn't know it. I suspect that some of these animals we're going to talk about were up there grazing.
Okay.
Don't think of it as in terms of a sun bath for these animals. They were there for a purpose.
Okay. Let's carry through with our imagery, if we could, Holmes Semkin. Let's put a highway or an interstate. Why not? They're a little safer. An interstate through this area that we're talking about here in Iowa, and we get a chance to drive on this interstate and look out and see not only, the glaciers, but also what animals are inhabiting our landscape.
You'd see a much more varied fauna than you see now. I like to think of the faunas that we were talking about previously, the deer, the mountain lion, and all of that, as a depauperate fauna. Because at the end, when we were driving through, if this were the ice ages, you would see two kinds of giant ground sloths roaming the landscape. You would see mammoths. You would see mastodons. You would see camels. You would see llamas. You would see a scimitar cat, which is very closely related to the saber-toothed cat. There were shrub oxen, some animals for which we don't have any real modern analogies. They're extinct. They've long since gone. And you would also see barren ground musk oxen, which today inhabit only the tundra. They were here.
And these are large animals.
They are large animals,
but,
yes.
But that time, they were not the largest.
They certainly were not. Sloths would tower over them, and mammoths, for the most part, would tower over the sloths. So would mastodons.
How large could a sloth become?
Well, we generally think of a sloth... It's sort of like people. There are 90-pound people and there are 400-pound people. So there's a range of sizes of the animals that we've found. We're very interested in the variation, the size with respect to their geography and things like that, because it does change across the landscape and so with their weight. But I think you can think of the weight of a large ox, something like that. For a mammoth or a mastodon, think African elephant.
Mm.
The Colombian mammoth was a little bit bigger than the African elephant. And, of course, African elephants are larger than Indian elephants. They're two different kinds of elephants. They're related to a degree, of course. And these mammoths that we had in Iowa are most closely related to the Indian elephant, or more closely related to the Indian elephant than they are the African elephant. Mm-hmm. But they were big animals. Mm-hmm. And we know there were two kinds of them here. We, at Oskaloosa, we were working on a dig with the Museum of Natural History. We've got on sort of a team that likes to dig these animals. And we discovered our first woolly mammoth, known from the state. And we've got more than one bone from it.
Why are there a lot of fossils from this period in Iowa?
We have quite a few. In terms, if you went out to hunt for one, you probably wouldn't find it. It was like your chances of seeing a cougar or something like that. They're there. It takes most of the specimens that we find are found by somebody else. A person is curious enough to bring it to the university to find out what it is.
Right.
And if they're curious enough to bring it here to find out what it is, they're interested. And all of a sudden, you're working with these people. And they like to go out, find things, and bring them to you.
I think a while back we had you on because it was actually a farmer who had discovered this. And this farmer was savvy enough to know that that was not a cattle bone he was looking.
Yeah, he knew that he had something very different.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this period, I understand that animals were 15 or 20% larger. Why would they be larger?
This is debatable, of course, but my favorite theory is that the graze was better. The forest was better. The environment was better. At the time of glaciation, people want to think cold. Well, the winters were probably a little bit colder. The coldest days in winter were probably a little bit colder. But the July temperatures were not nearly as high. Okay, so the climatic extremes over the year were greatly reduced. We'll talk about that in the annals, how it applies to the animals. In order that hot day in summer is a clear day, that cold day in winter is a clear day, if you want to reduce those extremes, you get clouds. Clouds frequently bring precipitation. Precipitation is rain in the south. It's snow in the north, and the snow makes glaciers. And so this is the reason the glaciers accumulated. The snow accumulated in the winter, and they weren't melting back so much in July and August. And so you got a net increase in the distribution of the ice sheets.
Mm. Holm Semkin is with us, Professor Emeritus of Geoscience at the University of Iowa, taking us back through the end of the last ice age to see what our landscape here in the Midwest might have looked like, might have sounded like. Do we know what it would have sounded like?
Well, elephants, as you know, trumpet. All animals are vocal, particularly during the mating season, but they have distress calls. Most of them are social to a point, and they like to communicate with each other. Hey, come over here. The graze is good. There would be sounds. There would be different kinds of sounds. It would be a lot like listening to something in Africa today.
Mm. I understand there's an interesting and a bit of a comical story connected with one type of sloth, a Jefferson's giant ground sloth.
That's correct.
Please tell that story.
Okay. The sloth that we dug south of Shenandoah that we talked about on a previous program is Jefferson's giant ground sloth. And it was named for Thomas Jefferson, who most people think of as a political individual, but he was very much into paleontology. He also was a party man, I might add. He loved the ladies. But let's not digress. Jefferson found, or somebody brought to Jefferson, as people do to me today, remains of a ground sloth. And he looked at it, and they have large claws. And he saw this claw, and he thought it must be a large lion. And so he even published, it would be nice to have heard the lion's roar back in the Ice Age. And following that, he read a publication by a person in South America who found a whole ground sloth. Jefferson just had the toe and a couple of fingers and things like this to work
with. Remind us what a sloth hand looks like.
It looks like three large claws. From the tip of the claw to the cuticle would be something on the order of 6 inches. I mean, this
on
is
one
a
of
big
these big fellows.
On one of these big fellows, yes, definitely. You wouldn't want one to take a swing at you.
They were not slothful in their if they encountered a danger?
We're not sure how fast they could move. We talk about ground sloths in terms of tree sloths, and they might have been quite different. They certainly didn't secure their food by active pursuit. Okay. I mean, there's no question they waddled when they walked bipedally. This was Jefferson sloth, was the only bipedal sloth. All the others, yeah. Knuckle and ankled sloth. But Jefferson discovered this. He thought it was a lion. He found out it was a sloth. And, of course, as you know, he was in Europe very frequently. And Count Buffon and Baron Cuvier were noted paleontologists at that time. And they thought everything in North America was diminutive. And so Jefferson, Lewis, and Clark felt there probably were mammoths and mastodons. He'd seen the teeth of mammoths. There's one in the Monticello today that he collected. There's a mastodon tooth there. So he took a tooth of a mastodon over to Europe with him and asked Baron Cuvier, is this what you mean by a diminutive animal? So then he proposed to Lewis and Clark, and one of the major reasons that he wanted them to go, personal reasons, I might say, they were diplomatic and obviously economic reasons, was to prove that mammoths and mastodons and giant ground sloths were still alive in North America so he could catch one and send it to France and show them. So,
and they were gone by that time.
They were gone. By 10,000 years ago, the sloths were gone, the mammoths were gone, the mastodons gone. And actually, there were 35 to 37 different large mammals that became extinct in that time over a period of a couple of thousand years. Some people think the extinction occurred over a period of just a few hundred years.
We've been talking about the larger mammals, but your specialty is actually in smaller, or what you call, I believe, micro mammals. How big are micro mammals?
Well, I think anything that you can put in a bread box, if it were alive, would be a micro mammal. So that would include the badgers and the rodents and the hares and the shrews.
And at this time, they would have been different. How?
Well, at this time, there would probably be 35 to 37 species of small mammals living around a cave, say in a county. And today, there are only 13 or 14 in that county. So there was a much more diverse fauna at that time. Now, unlike the large mammals, none of the small mammals became extinct. They were reorganized, and the small mammals that were in Iowa that were indicative of tundra, as was the barren ground muskox, are now living in tundra areas. And the small mammals that were living in eastern Iowa that were primarily plains have retreated to the west. The armadillos have retreated to the south. And the deer and things like that have sort of retreated to the east. And so now they're much more compartmentalized than they were during the ice ages. So when you're looking out of your kitchen window on the ice age landscape, you might see 9 or 10 different large mammals, a horse, a bison, a giant ground sloth or two, a mammoth, a mastodon. There were saiga, antelope kinds of animals that were running around out there. It would really be a very interesting place.
I wonder if we can go to any place in Iowa. You mentioned caves a moment ago, and we have, for instance, Maquoketa Caves.
Yes.
Are there any places in Iowa we can go where we could touch a stone, enter a cave, and reasonably assume that a prehistoric mammal lived there?
Oh, they certainly did live in there.
In the Maquoketa Caves, for
instance. Well, in the Maquoketa Caves. We've excavated in Wapsipinicon State Park. A couple of fissures there produced one of these microfaunas that I was talking about with 25, 26 different species in it. And I'm sure the same thing would be true in the Maquoketa Cave. Horse Thief Cave, I think it was in the Maquoketa Caves. Some years ago, Bill Furnish, who was in our department, walked out of his office and there was a bushel basket full of bones sitting there. And there was a note in there from Horse Thief Cave. And the person just set them down and ran. I guess he collected them, felt bad about it, and returned them, and we found some interesting animals. And actually, we found a pronghorn. This is in eastern Iowa, in that bushel basket of bones. So we know pronghorn were in the eastern part of the state. Now, this is post-glacial that we're talking about in Horse Thief Cave. Artifacts were involved in that.
Holmes Semkin with us for another few minutes on River to River. Holmes, since you specialize in small animals, a favorite of yours that you like to talk about in that class?
Well, I like to talk about the combination of them, But I guess everybody has their favorite, and mine is the collared lemming. Mm. And this is because they're just, they're like hamsters. They're cute little buggers. Most of them are. And they're not very social at all. You don't want to handle most of these things. And but they have an interesting life history. They go through cycles of abundance and retreat. They migrate. I say migrate. They disperse in droves when the populations or sizes are large. And why are they large some years and small other years? There are various ideas on that, but nobody really knows for sure. Maybe some sort of internal cycle.
How do we determine the age of specimens you find, if you find bones?
Okay. Most of the only really precise way to do this is the radiocarbon date. And yet radiocarbon dates on bones are expensive. That's because you have to extract the collagen from the bone. Because when the bone's in the ground, it absorbs groundwater. Groundwater has carbon in it that's from the plants and the roots. And you get a sort of an average date of everything that was there. But collagen is covalently bonded. It's very solidly bonded. And if it survives, you can date the carbon in that. And that carbon was carbon that the animal picked up while it was alive.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if our understanding of when the Ice Age happened and the animals, the mammals that lived at that time has changed in recent years. Have we progressed there as our technology, carbon dating, has progressed?
Oh, yeah. In terms of dating these things, we can date the actual bone unless they're leached, unless all the collagen's been removed. We can sometimes date the sediment that the bone is in. The mammoth site that we're working on at the present time, there are lots of seed pods. There are plant stems, limbs. Actually, we've got tree trunks at this particular site. And the ones that we've found have been washed out and they're sort of degraded. But we know pretty well where there's going to be one, and we'll be able to take that, section it, and look at the growth rings mm-hmm. and get some idea about the climate at the time as you interpret growth rings today. And you can also date the individual rings and find out how old that tree was, and is that the same age as your mammoth?
One of the titles you wear in your field is a vertebrate paleontologist?
That's correct.
In that area, in that specific field, are there raging controversies right now?
Oh, yes, there are always raging controversies. We're academics. And if you get four professors in a room, you're going to have five opinions on any subject. Yeah. And that certainly is true. It's true of the extinction of the Pleistocene mammals, whether people were the prime cause of it, whether it was climatic change, whether it was a comet that some people think came in and set the woods on fire. Other people think maybe it was a disease. The disease idea most people won't touch, not because it's impossible, but because there's no real way to prove it, at least at the present time. Whereas you can talk about climatic change and say, okay, this evidence puts this sort of climate at this time, and at a later time it's a very different kind of climate, and obviously the animal couldn't survive there. But also at that time we find the first stone tools in North America. And so the climate change also coincided with the immigration of man into North America, the first Americans, I think we should call them now. Out of my political correctness mode there.
So they only entered the picture, these, are they called paleo North Americans?
Yeah, paleo Indians, right.
When the last glaciers are receding, that's when they entered the picture?
Yeah, all of this occurred at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard. More precise dating really isn't going to help this particular aspect of the question because we know when it occurred and the major pulse of extinction and the entrance of people and the change in climate definitely coincided.
And they are Homo sapien as we
are. They're Homo sapiens. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so they came from where?
Eurasia, across the Bering Land Bridge. During the glacial period, a lot of the water that's now in the oceans was tied up in ice. And at that time, Alaska was attached to Beringia, which is eastern Siberia. And the animals just grazed their way from Eurasia into North America, into Alaska. And North American animals grazed their way into Eurasia at that particular time. The camel and the horse are both native to North America.
Do you happen to know, we have just a minute or so left, the earliest Paleo-American bone or artifact we have in this?
Yes, they dated about the same time, roughly around 10,000, 10,400 radiocarbon years before present.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's been enlightening to be with you. Have you share another half hour with us. Holmes Semkin, Professor Emeritus of Geoscience at the University of Iowa. We'll love to check in with you again.
I'd be delighted.
Thank you very much for giving us that picture out our kitchen window or our car window onto an ice age setting. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, we'll examine the Peregrine Financial Group scandal. Russell Wassendorf Sr. admitting to stealing millions of dollars from his firm. Also tomorrow on the program, I'll have renowned science writer Margaret Wertheim with us. I hope you'll join us for that. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today by Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Garrett Van Leeuwen. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.